Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
By listening first, strategizing second, and collaborating constantly, MetLife Investment Management takes a client-first approach to institutional investing. With expertise in public fixed income, private capital, and real estate, we are institutional, but far from typical. Learn more at MetLife.com/institutional. That's MetLife.com/institutional.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 14th of December, these are our main stories. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says he hopes his party's emphatic election victory will end the debate over Brexit and allow the process of healing to begin. A committee of the US House of Representatives has voted to send articles of impeachment against Donald Trump to the next stage in a process that could lead to a trial in the Senate. The United States and China have reached a provisional deal aimed at easing the trade war between the world's two largest economies. Also in this podcast...
Every time I open the door to go to my work, I don't know if this is the last goodbye.
Nearly 9 years after the start of the war in Syria, we assess daily life in the rebel-held territory of Idlib. Let the healing begin, the words of the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson on the steps of No. 10 Downing Street after winning a larger-than-expected Conservative majority in the British general election.
I am forming a new government, and on Monday, MPs will arrive at Westminster to form a new parliament. And I'm proud to say that members of our new One Nation government, a people's government, will set out from constituencies that have never returned a Conservative MP for 100 years. And yes, they will have an overwhelming mandate from this election to get Brexit done, and we will honour that mandate by January the 31st.
His victory came because traditional Labour voters in the North and Midlands of England abandoned the party and its leader Jeremy Corbyn, preferring Mr Johnson's promise to get Brexit done. Danny Savage spoke to a few people in the region.
Because I just feel like Labour's gone from the working class to the people who are on benefits. They're for the snowflake society, for the softer people who don't like reality and don't want to work hard and earn money honestly. And I think Conservative's more for the working class.
I think he's a people person. We want more money up here in the north, and hopefully, fingers crossed, he'll do that.
Is there a feeling that some people have lent their vote to the Conservatives this time and would go back to Labour?
I'm absolutely sure they would. If he doesn't fulfil what he's promised, I'm sure they would, yes.
What made you swap?
Jeremy Corbyn.
He was the problem for you?
Yes, yes.
So, less than 6 months since getting the job, Boris Johnson's being called the most successful Conservative leader since Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s. Does our political correspondent Rob Watson agree?
Sort of, but he's also been very, very lucky, Andrew. He only got just over 300,000 votes more than Mrs. May did in 2017. The real difference is that the Labour vote collapsed by over 2.5 million. And why this matters, Andrew, is that it shows you this was an ugly baby contest. What I mean by that is Mr. Johnson won not so much because he and the Conservatives were popular, but because they were marginally less unpopular than the losing parties.
Now, he's got a big parliamentary majority, which is going to make life easier than for his predecessor, Theresa May, but he's still got enormous challenges to deliver Brexit, to get it done, to use his phrase, in a very tight timeframe next year.
Yes, and of course, to keep the UK together. So on top of the problem of being a polarising and divisive figure and winner, as I said, of the ugly baby contest, Mr Johnson has to deliver on the most complex policy challenge any government has faced since 1945 in Brexit, and all at the same time as no doubt having a fight on his hands to stop the disintegration of the UK. Now, that's given the strong showing of the pro-independent Scottish National Party at the election. Now, Mr Johnson called the SNP leader, Nicola Sturgeon, a few hours ago to say he wouldn't allow a second referendum on independence, but she has made clear that she believes the Scottish people who had voted to remain in the EU in 2016 should be given their say.
It is clear beyond any doubt that the kind of future desired by the majority in Scotland is very different to that chosen by much of the rest of the UK. Scotland has rejected Boris Johnson and the Tories, and yet again we have said no to Brexit.
And it's not just Scotland where Mr Johnson has a potential problem. For the first time, Northern Ireland has elected more MPs who favour a united Ireland. And Brexit has raised the whole awkward existential question of Northern Ireland's status. Should it be British, Irish, Northern Irish? So Mr Johnson could find himself battling to leave one union while fighting to save another.
Our political correspondent Rob Watson. As we just heard, there's been a significant change in the electoral map of Northern Ireland, where for the first time, MPs who mainly favour a united Ireland now outnumber those who support a continued union with the United Kingdom. The Democratic Unionists won 8 seats but lost 2, including North Belfast, held by their deputy leader Nigel Dodds. Sinn Féin won 7 seats, the SDLP gained 2, the Alliance Party gained 1. Our Ireland correspondent Chris Page reports from North Belfast.
This is Alexandra Park, a green space split in two by an 8-foot-tall barrier built to separate unionist and nationalist communities. A week ago, I came here to ask voters about the key contest in Northern Ireland. The DUP's Westminster leader, Nigel Dodds, was challenged by the Sinn Féin candidate, John Finucane, whose father, Pat, a solicitor, was murdered by loyalists during the Troubles. Mr Finucane's victory was the highlight of a breakthrough night for nationalism. Today, people in this constituency were reflecting on the unseating of the most senior DUP MP by an Irish Republican.
There's been an awful lot of sadness about Nigel Dodds not getting through because he's been part of this community for such a long time.
Sinn Féin tend to get a lot done on the ground, so I have faith that they will get things moving.
Everything's in stalemate for so long, it'll be nice to see what they can do and see if they can bring about positive change.
Elsewhere, 2 landslide victories by the nationalist SDLP mean there are now more MPs who favour a united Ireland than support the union. The Cross-Community Alliance Party also enjoyed success. It won a Westminster seat for only the second time and came third in terms of the overall number of votes. The electoral trend of unionists losing ground has continued. That'll generate more debate about Northern Ireland's long-term future in the UK.
Chris Page in Belfast in Northern Ireland. A fierce row has already broken out within Labour about who should lead the party after Jeremy Corbyn stands down and in what direction they should take it. Our political correspondent Ian Watson considers what lies ahead for a defeated and divided opposition.
A brutal leadership battle is almost inevitable. The likely candidates are keeping their powder dry, but skirmishes have begun over the reasons for Labour's lowest tally of seats since the 1930s. Those close to Jeremy Corbyn blamed Brexit, media hostility, even the weather. The party chairman Ian Lavery singled out Labour's commitment to a second referendum, and Laura Parker from the left-wing grassroots group Momentum insisted Jeremy Corbyn was the victim of unfortunate political timing.
I'm not sure it's so much what he did wrong, but clearly we as a party collectively, we've not managed to break through the Brexit fog. All these fantastic things we've wanted to do, they've not had the hearing that we would have wanted them to have had. And I think that, in the end, is what has cost us this election.
Some insiders say Mr Corbyn is now offering to stay on until the profile of another left-winger, Rebecca Long-Bailey, is raised. But senior Corbyn critics have told me they'll push for their leader to go sooner rather than later. They want the responsibility for failure to be laid at the door of the party leadership, clearing the ground for a candidate such as Sir Keir Starmer, Emily Thornberry or Jess Phillips, who'd move away from the Corbyn agenda. The Labour peer Ian McNicol was the party's most senior official during the 2017 election campaign. He says this historic defeat wasn't only due to the party leader, but to what he symbolised.
It's the ideology. It's not just Jeremy, it's the wider Corbynism in the politics round about that have helped lead us to this terrible result.
The veteran MP Margaret Hodge has suggested, with the row over anti-Semitism and a rise in online abuse, that Labour has become the new nasty party. It can detoxify. Many seats were lost by narrow margins. But the question facing the membership is whether to settle simply for a new leader or to demand a new direction.
our political correspondent Ian Watson. What's the reaction been from British businesses to the election result? Our reporter Rob Young has been to a factory in the rural county of Derbyshire in the English East Midlands.
I've visited many factories over the years, but this must be one of the most unusual. It is carpeted, for a start. And the motorbikes which are being made here are being manufactured by hand. Not a single robot in sight. This is Norton Motorcycles in the south of Derbyshire. With me is the chief executive, Stuart Garner. Hi, Stuart.
Hiya.
Tell me a bit about this beautiful piece of machinery just in front of us.
Yeah, well, we're looking there at the all-new Norton V4 SS. Will take you 0 to 60 in probably a second and a half if you can hang on. A complete rocket machine, proudly engineered, designed, developed here at the factory.
And you're just as happy about the bike as you are about the election result.
I'm so relieved. Hopefully now, with the result, we've got some clarity and some direction, and the MPs can go and properly do the job, what we pay them to do. I think we've a wonderful opportunity ahead of us now.
Most of the bikes that you make here are exported. What might Brexit mean for where you export and the costs involved?
The tantalising prospect for us is that we manage to get some free trade agreements and we get some of our larger export markets more open. For example, if we want to go to India or China or South America, huge motorbike markets, they're generally around 60% tariff. So for us to send in a £20,000 motorbike would create £12,000 worth of duty. So it makes us uneconomic in those territories. India, for example, last year purchased 20 million motorcycles. So what a huge territory that, and in essence, under the EU rulebook, we're ruled out.
The government hopes to do a trade agreement with the European Union by the end of 2020. If it doesn't, Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, has said he wouldn't extend the so-called implementation period where pretty much everything stays the same.
Yes.
And so there is the potential of a no-deal Brexit still at the end of 2020. Mm. Are you not worried that there may be trade barriers put in the way of your sales into the European Union?
There's always the opportunity for a negative outcome. That's kind of life, and that's no different in this scenario. Should we get a negative situation for Britain into Europe, Europe, of course, gets a negative situation coming to Britain. So while that's not anything to negotiate on, it is something to think that you might get some common sense come through. And from our perspective, if we're ruled out of the EU with a no deal and large tariffs and difficult regulations, so would BMW, Ducati, Aprilia coming back into the UK. So you would expect our UK sales to pick up at the expense of our European competitors not being able to come in, and our European sales to slow because we couldn't go there. But I think the politicians have seemed to have had conversation to say that they're broadly agreed on tariffs and the way to do the trade agreement. But of course, a year doesn't look a long time, and it doesn't look a long time in the context of how they've performed in the last 12 months. Having said that, I'm a great believer in the glasses half full, and having somebody committed with a good majority, fingers crossed, the government can get behind this and make this a success. Now they've got opportunity and a clear mandate to go about and process what they believe they want to do.
Stuart Garner from Norton Motorcycles, ending that report by Rob Young from the English Midlands. European Union leaders have cautiously welcomed the Conservative election victory in Britain, saying the EU is ready to move into a new and unprecedented partnership. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has said he wants an agreement on future relations with the bloc agreed by the end of 2020. The President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, warned that would be very challenging as there were many issues to negotiate and Europe wanted a level playing field.
Our goal is we aim at zero tariffs, zero quota, zero dumping. This is important for us and this is what we work for.
In a speech in Downing Street, Mr. Johnson spoke of his determination to build a new partnership with the EU, saying he wanted to work together as friends. Our reality check correspondent Chris Morris considers whether the Conservative Brexit timetable is realistic.
The Prime Minister's first Brexit promise to leave the EU on January the 31st is now clearly achievable. He has the majority in Parliament and the first phase of Brexit will soon be over. Symbolically and legally, that's really important. But he's also got to negotiate an ambitious trade agreement with the EU extremely quickly and get it ratified before the post-Brexit transition period ends in just over a year's time. That will be far more difficult to achieve, especially if Mr. Johnson wants to diverge from the EU rules and regulations that the UK currently follows. A basic zero tariff, zero quota deal is the most realistic option, but that would still mean a variety of checks and related costs and bureaucracy that businesses trading in goods with Europe don't have to cope with now. Formal negotiations on a trade deal are unlikely to begin until March, and by July a decision has to be made on whether the transition period should be extended to give more time to finalise and implement an agreement. But the Prime Minister has already promised the transition will not be extended, so unless he changes course, which he might, that could threaten a potential crunch point in December 2020. Finally, Mr. Johnson has promised that after the transition, there will be no checks on goods moving within the UK between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, even though that's exactly what his own withdrawal agreement creates. So, after the end of January, attention will focus on which of the Prime Minister's promises he can keep, which he can't keep, and which he might be tempted to tweak a bit.
Our correspondent, Chris Morris. Now, every weekend you can hear a review of the week's main stories and why they matter in our programme, The World This Week. Here's Sean Lay.
Thank you. Yes, as you might expect, it's a one-item programme this week, all about the general election we've just had in the UK, what it means for the future of the Union, for Britain's relationship with Europe and the world.
Thanks, Sean. That's in The World This Week, broadcast on Saturdays and Sundays and available to download from our website. Now to other stories. In the United States, a key congressional committee has approved two articles of impeachment against President Trump, setting the stage for a full vote in the House of Representatives next week. The Judiciary Committee voted along party lines on charges of abuse of power and obstruction of justice. The president reacted defiantly.
It's a witch hunt. It's a sham. It's a hoax. Nothing was done wrong. Zero was done wrong. I think it's a horrible thing to be using the tool of impeachment, which is supposed to be used in an emergency, and it would seem many, many, many years apart. It's a scam. It's something that shouldn't be allowed, and it's a very bad thing for our country, and you're trivializing impeachment.
If the president is impeached in the House, a trial on whether to remove him from office would then take place in the Senate, where the Republican majority would most likely acquit him. Our Washington correspondent, Anthony Zercher, looks at the impeachment process.
Thank you all for being here. Thank you for being with us. Thank you very much. Thank you.
The holiday season is here, a joyous time of camaraderie and goodwill, tacky Christmas jumpers and office parties. Washington is not immune to the lure of such festivities, and on Thursday night, the White House held its own posh holiday gathering for congressional legislators. There were, however, some notable absences. While the party was getting underway at the White House, down on Pennsylvania Avenue near the U.S. Capitol, the House Judiciary Committee hearing on whether to remove the president from office was stretching well into the night. Democrats and Republicans wrangled over two formal articles of impeachment being considered, one charging the president with abuse of power and the other on obstruction of Congress. Both arise from what Democrats allege was the president's efforts to use the authority of his office to pressure the Ukrainian government to publicly announce investigations that could be to the president's personal political benefit. The arguments presented by both sides were familiar, and despite the hours of debate, the outcome seemed clear. Democrats frame this as a sad but necessary step to contain a rogue president. Republicans suggested it was the latest effort by the powers of the status quo to block his populist groundswell and overturn the results of the 2016 presidential election. There had been some debate in the past few weeks about the parameters of the impeachment charges. Would the president be accused of additional misdeeds stemming from Robert Mueller's Russia collusion investigation? Could there be allegations of business misconduct as well? In the end, House Democrats took a narrow focus, prompting one congressional reporter to wonder why.
Madam Speaker, you yourself accused him of bribery. Why did you decide not to make bribery one of the articles of impeachment?
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who was a grudging convert to the impeachment cause, stood by her party's decision.
I myself am not a lawyer. Sometimes I act like one. Not as often as I act as a doctor. I practice medicine on the side without benefit of diploma, too. The articles are what they are. They're very powerful. They're very strong.
Pelosi is urging members of her party to vote their conscience next week when the full House will consider the two articles of impeachment. Some Democrats from Trump-friendly areas may be allowed to break ranks and vote against one or both charges to ease their path to re-election next November. Call it an early Christmas present from the House Speaker. When Pelosi made her announcement of a formal impeachment inquiry 80 days ago, many predicted that wheels were being set in motion that would be impossible to stop. With a comfortable majority in the chamber, Democrats are now poised to carry the day and make Donald Trump only the third president in history to be impeached. Republicans, meanwhile, are sticking with the president through thick and thin. Oh, and don't feel bad for the Republican legislators who missed Thursday night's Christmas party. The White House has promised to host another party just for them. A special thank you to some of the president's most ardent defenders.
Anthony Zurcher reporting. The United States and China have reached a provisional trade agreement in the first significant move to de-escalate the grueling trade war between the world's two largest economies. Donald Trump said the Phase 1 deal would suspend tariffs due to take effect this week in exchange for Beijing increasing imports of American agricultural products. From Beijing, here's Stephen McDonnell.
While specific figures have not been released, both sides are hailing this as a breakthrough. Beijing and Washington have said that an enforceable trade pact has been reached. At a late-night press conference here in Beijing, Chinese officials said that under Phase 1, the United States would cancel penalty tariffs due to be implemented this weekend. In turn, China would buy more U.S. agricultural products. The detail of the text is yet to be released. U.S. President Donald Trump confirmed the agreement via Twitter, saying that Phase 2 negotiations would commence immediately. However, there's still a last round of talks before this deal is actually signed.
Stephen McDonnell in China. There have been mass street protests in Algeria following Thursday's presidential elections, in which only pro-establishment candidates were allowed to stand. Abdelmajid Tebboune has been declared the winner with 58% of the votes. More from our North Africa reporter, Bassam Bouneni.
Just after the announcement of Tebboune's victory, Algerians took again to the streets, saying they do not recognize the election nor its outcome. So the situation is quite embarrassing for the freshly elected president.
So he's got international recognition, but not yet sufficient acknowledgement and acceptance of the election result in his own country.
He has to address the popular movement, a movement that do not recognize the election, do not recognize the whole process since President Abdelaziz Bouteflika resigned in last April. We've seen scenes of deserted polling stations yesterday. The turnout is around 39%. More than 1 million ballots have been cancelled, according to the Electoral Monitoring Authority.
And for the people who are not happy with the outcome, what do they want to happen instead?
They want a transitional period. They want to get rid of what they call the inner circle of former President Abdelaziz Bouteflika, including Tebboune. And Tebboune wasn't the only one who served under Bouteflika's regime. All the five runners served under Bouteflika's regime. And that was one of the main reasons why the popular movement rejected the election.
Bassam Bouneni with me from Tunis. It's almost 9 years since the war in Syria began, yet it's still far from over. With help from his Russian and Iranian allies, President Assad now controls over 70% of the country, but has yet to retake most of the opposition-held northern province of Idlib. This is despite a major ground offensive launched last April, which has caused many civilian casualties and forced hundreds of thousands to flee their homes. Following the collapse of an agreed ceasefire deal in August, there's been heavy bombing in recent weeks, and the situation on the ground is becoming increasingly desperate. Our correspondent Mike Thompson has been speaking to people there.
A helicopter is now bombing with explosive barrels.
The last few weeks have been terrifying for many civilians in Idlib.
We are going to leave our village. We don't know where to go.
Nur, who describes himself as a humanitarian activist, lives just to the west of Idlib city. With oil and electricity both in short supply and winter now setting in, he fears that if the bombs don't get you, the cold will.
We had to destroy our couches to get wood to put in the fireplace. Break our closets, burn them. The clothes, the shoes, we burned clothes.
Syrian regime tanks rolled into Idlib in April after Islamist extremists Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, who now control the province, refused to leave an agreed demilitarized buffer zone there. Russian and Syrian planes stand accused of deliberately targeting more than 60 health facilities in Idlib in 2019 alone. But Dr. Omar al-Hiraki, who runs one of the few major hospitals still operating there, fears that something even more frightening may be about to happen.
We have a threat that the Syrian regime will attack with chemical weapons.
Dr. Al-Haraki's fears are based on a story posted on Russia's Defense Ministry website and carried by the country's Sputnik newspaper, alleging that Idlib extremists and white helmet civil defense workers have brought chlorine gas into the province. So he believes enabling pro-Assad forces to claim that any coming chemical attack wasn't done by them.
This media misinformation by the Russian and Syrian regime is exactly what happened before. The chemical attack in eastern Ghouta near Damascus in 2013 and in Khan Shaykhun in 2017. It's the same lie.
Radio Fresh.
The Catherine Bell Studios of Idlib's famous Radio Fresh, whose founder, Raed Faris, opposed both Assad and local Islamist extremists, was bombed last weekend. Presenter Hibar Aboud has now joined hundreds of thousands of people in fleeing their homes and heading north for the Turkish border, even though it's closed.
The prices are going up as the currency decreases against the dollar. And we came here without anything. We just had the clothes we were wearing. And now it's becoming almost impossible to live under the expensive circumstances.
And this is what faces those like Nur, who stay behind.
Every time I open the door to go to my work, I don't know if this is the last goodbye.
Mike Thompson reporting. Back to our main story, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's re-election with a commanding majority and his promise to deliver Brexit and unite the country after the British general election. Our political editor Laura Koonsberg is outside 10 Downing Street.
When MPs get back to the House of Commons, he can enter the chamber as Prime Minister at the dispatch box, absolutely confident that behind him are not people looking for a way to shove him out. Behind him are people who are fully signed up to his programme, fully committed, and that means by the end of next month, in a matter of weeks, he will have been able to get the laws required to take us out of the European Union through Parliament, and that means that we are heading out of the European Union at the end of next month. That's the biggest thing of all to say about this. Second of all, though, in terms of what it means for our political landscape, it means at least for the next few years, probably 5 years, we're looking at something very, very different. We're looking at a Tory party representing communities in places where they've never represented those voices of our viewers in different pockets of the country. That's going to sound different, that's going to feel different, that's going to look different. The bigger question, though, is that a permanent shift? Has Boris Johnson really managed today to redraw the map forever? Of course, in truth, as Labour has discovered to its cost today, the map's always moving. And parties never own their voters. It's voters who have the right to be represented and the right for parties to listen to them.
Laura Koonsberg outside 10 Downing Street. And that's all from us for now. There will be an updated version of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this podcast or the stories we included, do drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. My name's Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
Here's a question. A man escapes from one of the world's most brutal dictatorships. He's risked everything to do it. But once he's free, he digs a hole and he tunnels straight back in again. Why? I'm Helena Merriman, and over the past 6 months, I've been investigating an extraordinary escape story for the BBC. A story involving a tunnel, a spy, and an American TV network. It's called Tunnel 29. Just search for Tunnel 29 wherever you get your podcasts.
By listening first, strategizing second, and collaborating constantly, MetLife Investment Management takes a client-first approach to institutional investing. With expertise in public fixed income, private capital, and real estate, we are institutional, but far from typical. Learn more at MetLife.com/institutional. That's MetLife.com/institutional.